The church janitor and another helper of the church were our witnesses. Afterwards, we had our reception over on 103rd and 3rd at our friend's apartment, Sam and Trafina Ruth Wilson. They decorated the apartment with pink and white tissue streamers and laid out beautiful trays of delicate sandwiches, entrees, cake, and coffee, and Reverend Brown stopped over to join us. It was a lovely reception, just the five of us. I didn't need a million roses and a marching band. My husband loved me, and I loved him, and that's all I needed. We were sitting in Ruth's house having coffee at our reception, and my husband, oh, I was proud to say it too, my husband, said to me, "We have to be strong. You know what people will say about us, Ruth. They'll try to break us up." I said, "I know. I'll be strong." And over the years we were tested, but we never split up or even spent a night apart, except when he took the kids to North Carolina to see his parents. I could never go south with him because of the danger. The first time I went south with him was the last time, when I took his body down there to bury him. After we had our first baby in 1943, we moved across the street to a one-room kitchenette that cost $6 a week. We had a sink, bed, dresser, stove, and a little icebox that the guy came around and put ice in once a week. All our furniture was stuff we found or bought from Woolworth and could be folded, folding chairs, folding tables. Our window faced an alley and the brick wall of the next building, and it was so close to the adjoining building you couldn't tell whether it was raining or snowing outside. You had to stick your head out the window to see what the weather was. The bathroom was in the hallway and used by all the tenants, and there were roaches everywhere. No matter how many you killed, they kept coming back. I kept my church hat on a shelf in a hat box, and every Sunday I'd pick it up to take my hat out. Roaches would crawl out. We had four kids in one room. We used the dresser drawers as cribs, and the kids slept with us or on fold-out cots. We lived in that one room for 9 years. Those 9 years were the happiest years of my life. I met an interesting white woman during that time, my friend Lily. I saw her in the park on 127th one day while I had my kids out, and she had her two kids with her. She was white and her children looked like mine, so we started talking. She was Jewish from Florida. Her family was rich and she was very refined. Lily was into books and opera. And we had black husbands, so we had that in common. Lily's husband was West Indian, and they were members of the Communist Youth Movement. Back then, that was like boom trouble. Maybe the government was looking out on them or something. Me and Dennis weren't for communism. We were for Jesus Christ. Lily and I were friends for a long time till she moved away to California. Her husband left her for a younger woman. She was too good for him anyway. He chased around anything in a skirt. In fact, chased me around when she wasn't looking, but I wouldn't have it. She became a Hare Krishna or one of those wild religions, and later she got married again, and this time to a white man. I was supposed to go visit her back in the 70s, but just before I did, she wrote me a nasty letter saying don't come and a lot of other mean, insulting things. So I called off my trip and never heard from her again. I don't know why she did that. I think she might have had some problems with her children. That might have been at the bottom of it, because over the years we wrote and I always talked about mine. But her kids had some problems. Our family grew so fast, before I knew it, me and Dennis and four kids were cramped in that one room. So we applied to get an apartment in the Red Hook housing projects in Brooklyn. They put us on a long waiting list and said, "Don't expect much." Because to get in there was a political thing, but God made a way for us, and we got in there in 1950. They gave us a two-bedroom apartment on the sixth floor of 795 Hicks Street with a bathroom. That was the greatest part of it, to have your own bathroom. The floors and the walls were pure cement, and the kids would get scruffs and big bruises from falling on it, and the glasses and the plates had to be replaced with plastic ones because once you dropped them, they smashed. But Red Hook was beautiful in those days. It was integrated, Indians, Puerto Ricans, Jews, and blacks. There was grass on the center mall and a playground with slides and monkey bars. It was a real American life. the life I'd always dreamed of. I'd kiss Dennis in the mornings when he left for work, and he'd come home in the evening, and I'd stand by the window and watch him turn the corner and walk down the center mall. I remember him clearly. His walk, his white shirt, his shoes. The kids would run down to meet him and wrap around his legs like puppies. He would bring groceries from the A&P and a surprise for the kids. A cupcake from his lunch or chewing gum. I loved that man. I never missed home or my family after I got married. My soul was full. We went to Metropolitan for a couple of years after moving to Red Hook, but Reverend Brown had died of a sudden heart attack, and it became too much to ride the subway all the way up to Harlem every Sunday with all the kids. Plus, Dennis had gotten the calling to preach, and he said he wanted to start a church. He quit drinking beer and enrolled at the Shelton Bible College and got his divinity degree from there in 1953. Then he went out and invited our neighbors from Red Hook to come to a prayer meeting at our house on Wednesday nights and Sunday mornings. Mrs. Ingram and your godparents, the McNairs, the Floods, the Taylors, they were the first ones to come. I'd clear off the table and put a white tablecloth on it, and that would be Dennis's pulpit. After that got going good, he said he needed to find a church. I said, how can we afford a church? With his little salary, we could barely afford to feed our kids. We had gone from 4 kids to 5 to 6 to 7. I mean, after a while, they just dropped like eggs, and we loved having them. But I couldn't see how we could afford a church with all these kids. Your sister Helen, I didn't have one prenatal visit to a clinic or anything when I had her. I just walked into the hospital and dropped her like an egg and went home. How we fed them, well, it was meal to meal. I shopped at Goodwill for their clothes and for their Christmas gifts, and I'd walk them around and let them play outside. I'd keep 2 in a stroller and 2 next to me, and the rest, I just kept them close. God just provided somehow. Dennis kept poking around till he found an empty building that was cheap near Red Hook. The white man who owned it didn't want to rent it to blacks, so I went over there and signed the lease by myself. And when the man saw me and your father and your godfather walking in there the next day, carrying paint cans and tools to fix it up with, he wanted his building back. But it was too late. We named it New Brown Memorial after Reverend Brown. The new members kept it going strong, and after we got about 60 people together regularly, we moved to a building on 195 Richard Street that had heat. Because Dennis was constantly toting heaters around in that other building, which was freezing. Our church survived real well until 1957, when Dennis came home from work with a bad cold. He was so hoarse, I made him lie down and rest. He was hoarse in bed about 3 weeks. He smoked cigarettes, filterless Lucky Strikes. And he got hoarse from time to time from preaching and the church not having good heat. And plus, it was January and cold outside, so I thought nothing of it. But he got so he couldn't get up out of bed, and he wouldn't eat, and he ran a fever. So I took him to St. Peter's Hospital. There were a lot of stares in the hospital when we went in there. Stares and questions from the doctors and nurses asking, who's that? And are you his wife? And all this. But I ignored them. I just wanted Dennis to get out and come home because the kids and I missed him. Our entire world revolved around him. The kids would sit and meditate just like him, then brag to each other how they would show him their meditation when he got home. Your sister Rosetta wouldn't let anyone sit in his chair while he was in the hospital, not even me. No one was allowed to. He seemed to get seriously ill very quickly. One day he was walking around, the next day he was hoarse and laid up in the hospital. The doctors didn't know what was wrong with him. Something in his lungs, this one said. Something in his pancreas, the other one said. They'd put me off when I'd ask. They'd talk about him in a general way to me, and then they'd go into the hallway and point at me with their chins and make remarks about me and Dennis, which they thought I couldn't hear. I could hear them, but I ignored them. I was focused on my husband. Every day when I'd walk home from the hospital, my friend Lillian would stick her head out the window in the projects and ask, how's Reverend McBride? And I'd say, he didn't eat today. And she'd say, well, he's got to get worse before he gets better. Then one day when I passed by her window, I was smiling and happy to tell Lillian, "He ate a grapefruit today." And she said, "See, I told you, he's got to get worse before he gets better." But he didn't get better. He got worse and worse. And during this time, I missed my period. I had 7 kids, and I had no time to think about my period. I thought it was stress because Dennis was in the hospital longer than I wanted him to be. But when I told him about it, he said, "If it's a boy, we'll call him James after my Uncle Jim." And that's how you got named. See, I didn't think he was going to die. I had no idea. But he knew, because he named you. And he'd make remarks like, "I know the Lord Jesus Christ will take care of y'all should anything happen to me. Don't worry, Ruth. Just trust in God." I wouldn't hear of such talk, and I would make him stop. Sometimes in the hospital, I would go into the hallway and cry so Dennis wouldn't see me. And one night I was standing there crying, and these 2 white doctors came by and said, "Who are you?" Because it was past normal visiting hours. I pointed to Dennis's room and said, "My husband is in there." And they just got so cold and disgusted, they talked about me right in front of my face and walked away. One afternoon, after Dennis had been in there a few weeks, I went to see him. And he was getting thin now from not eating. And he said, "Why don't you bring the kids by to see me?" I said, "We shouldn't do that because they had school, plus they didn't let kids inside the hospital, and I couldn't drag 7 kids up there." I really didn't want them to see him ill like that. The oldest of them was 13, but they really wanted to see him too, so I said, "Okay, I'll bring them by the window and you can see them from the window." It was on the 2nd floor, so I went home and got all the kids and brought them down to the hospital, and they stood on the street and yelled up for him, "Daddy, Daddy!" And Dennis came to the window in his bathrobe, and he looked down at them and waved to them. And from the expression on his face, him standing there waving at the children who were so excited to see him, I got a horrible feeling in my heart. I told myself, "Lord, he won't die, will he? He's my husband. He's my dream. He won't die now, will he, Lord?" I had no idea what to do. It just seemed like it wasn't going to happen. I went home and I prayed to the Lord not to take my husband. And then, a few days later, he died. Lord, he just died. I was home and got a call from the doctor at the hospital about 6 in the morning. He asked if I was Mrs. McBride, and I said I was. He said, "Mr. McBride just passed away." And I said, "That's impossible. He wasn't that sick." The doctor said he had cancer and hung up. That was the first time they told me he had cancer. That's the first time I ever heard of it. I stood there, I looked out the window over those projects. It was April 5th, 1957. I remember to the day. It was just getting to be the break of day. And I looked out there, and there was a blackness that came over me. A sinking feeling like I was going right down into blackness. The children woke up and they huddled together crying, and I started to cry. Part of me died when Dennis died. I loved that man more than life itself, and at times I wished the good Lord would have taken me instead of him, because he was a much better person for living than me. He just had so much more to give the world than me. He brought me a new life. He revived me after I left my family, brought me to Jesus, opened my eyes to a new world, and then passed on himself. Lord, it was hard, very hard to let him go. I was angry at him for dying for a while afterwards, angry that he left me with all those kids. But more than that, I missed him. We buried him down in High Point, North Carolina. I was in shock a lot of the time, really. And it was your Aunt Candace and your sister Jack who got me and the kids together for the funeral in Brooklyn and then to North Carolina for the funeral down there. It was the first time and the last that I ever went south with him. I couldn't leave his side after the funeral in Brooklyn, and I would have ridden with his body in the back of the train if they'd let me, but they didn't. But I sat on that train and said to myself, "I'm going to take him home. I will take him home to see him buried, and no white man nor black man would have stopped me from doing it, and I swear before God Almighty, had anyone stood before me to prevent me from doing it, I would have struck them down. When we got to the train station in High Point, Dennis's Uncle Jim went to claim the body at the counter, and I went with him. And the white man at the counter said, "Who's this body for?" And I said, "It's for me." And he kept looking at me and Uncle Jim, and he asked us again, "Who's this body for?" And Uncle Jim tried to say the body was with him so as not to make trouble with that white man. But I told Uncle Jim, "No, Uncle Jim, that's my husband there," I told that man. "That is my husband, and I've come here to bury him, and he is with me." It caused a little commotion, but he gave us no trouble and signed it over to me and Uncle Jim, and we buried Dennis in the Burns Hill Cemetery. I was 36 then, and I had been with Dennis nearly 16 years, and I'd never functioned without him. I remember walking through the projects with my 7 kids and crying. I'd just break out in tears in the middle of the day sometimes. Your sister Helen was about 9 years old then, and she said, "Don't cry, Mama. Daddy's up in heaven." And it just made me cry more. It was a hard, hard time. When we came back to New York after burying Dennis, I opened up our mailbox and found it full of checks and money orders and cash in envelopes from people in the projects who knew us and people from Metropolitan Church in Harlem. Dozens of letters with checks and money in them. I'll never forget that as long as I live. Folks sent us oranges and apples and chickens and turkeys and clothes, and if someone had anything extra, they just gave it to us. The people at his job, McCoy Publishing, the white people, they sent us money. Your sister Jack and Aunt Candace, who came up from North Carolina to stay with us, and your godparents, the McNairs and the Ingrams, and my old friend Irene Johnson, they all pitched in. But even with their help, we struggled. I was so desperate, I went back to my Jewish family to ask for help. I looked up my Aunt Betts, who had gotten married to a rich man and was living in a fancy building on the east side of Manhattan with a doorman. I had to talk my way past the doorman to get inside. When I knocked on the door of her apartment, Aunt Betts opened the door, saw who I was, and slammed the door in my face. I left there, and I cried openly on the sidewalk. Then I called my sister Gladys, who was living in Queens. "You promised me you wouldn't leave," she said. I told her I was sorry, but she wasn't really pleased to hear from me. "Call me tomorrow," she said. But when I called the next day, her husband picked up the phone and said, "She doesn't want to speak to you. Don't ever call here again." And he hung up on me. See, they were done with me. When Jews say Kaddish, they're not responsible for you anymore. You're dead to them. Saying Kaddish and sitting Shiva, that absolves them of any responsibility for you. I was on my own then, but I wasn't alone because, like Dennis said, God the Father watched over me and sent me your stepfather, who took over and saved us and did many, many things for us. He wasn't a minister like Dennis. He was different. A working man who had never been late for work in the 30 years that he worked for the New York City Housing Authority. And he was a good, good man. I met him after you were born, and after a while he asked me to marry him, and Aunt Candace said, "Marry that man, Ruth, marry him." And she'd clean the house spotless and cook up those splendid meals when your stepfather came by to make me look good. He thought I was making up those tasty yams and pork chops, and I can't cook to save my life. When I told him the truth, he said it didn't matter, that he wanted to marry me anyway, even though his brothers thought he was crazy. I had 8 children, but I wasn't ready to marry. I turned him down 3 times. I took you down to North Carolina to show you to Dennis's parents, Etta and Nash, in late 57. They only lasted 4 or 5 years after their only child died. And when I told Grandma Etta I was thinking of marrying again, she said, "God bless you, Ruth, because you're our daughter now. Marry that man." That's how black folks thought back then. That's why I never veered from the black side. I would have never even thought of marrying a white man. When I told your stepfather about how my sister and Aunt Betts treated me, he spoke about them without bitterness or hate. "You don't need them to help you," he said. I'll help you for the rest of my life if you'll marry me. Which I did. And God bless him. He was as good as his word.
Come to God. God's in the blessing business. It's October 1994, the 40th anniversary gala of the New Brown Memorial Baptist Church, and a deacon stands before the audience to muster them up for prayer. Though New Brown is located in Brooklyn, the 60 parishioners are gathered in this tiny banquet room at the Ramada Hotel at LaGuardia Airport in Queens, because somebody knew one of the hotel cooks, and they gave the church a discount. It isn't the Plaza Hotel four-star service, but it will do. The room is dank, dark, and cold. The meat is lousy, the waiter's busy. Somebody came up with the idea of hiring a gospel band with a keyboard player who wears shades and plays too loud, but no one's complaining. This is a celebratory night, and the parishioners are dressed in their best. For 40 years, New Brown, located in the Red Hook Housing Projects, one of the largest and most neglected housing projects in New York City, has stood strong. For 40 years, the parishioners have struggled. For 40 years, they have persevered and spread God's word. This is Mommy's home church. This is the church where I got married. This is the church my father, Andrew McBride, built. He never lived to see his dreams fulfilled. But when I thumb through his old brown briefcase filled with his paperwork from 45 years ago, the notes and papers he left behind reveal a man in constant thought. References to Dostoevsky, Faulkner, Paul Laurence Dunbar, Jackie Robinson, and notebooks upon notebooks filled with sermons and Bible verses. His writing was filled with allusions to Chronicles, Isaiah, the Book of John, and Philippians. Sometimes, without conscious realization, our thoughts, our faith, our interests are entered into the past, he wrote. We talk about other times, other places, other persons, and lose our living hold on the present. Sometimes we think, if we could just go back in time, we would be happy. But anyone who attempts to re-enter the past is sure to be disappointed. Anyone who has ever revisited the place of his birth after years of absence is shocked by the differences between the way the place actually is and the way he has remembered it. He may walk along old, familiar streets and roads, but he is a stranger in a strange land. He has thought of this place as home, but he finds he is no longer here even in spirit. He has gone on to a new and different life, and in thinking longingly of the past, he has been giving thought and interest to something that no longer really exists. This being true of the physical self, how much more true it is of the spiritual self. He wrote Bible verses on anything he could find. Small slips of paper, the back of train schedules, pay stubs. Next to some of the verses, he'd scribbled the names and phone numbers of doctors who he thought might be able to help him, cure him of the lung cancer that got him at age 45. But they couldn't help him then. It was his time to go, and he knew it. He left behind no insurance policy, no dowry, no land, no money for his pregnant wife and young children, but he helped establish the groundwork for Ma's raising 12 children, which lasted 30 years. Kids not allowed out after 5 o'clock. Stay in school, don't ever follow the crowd, and follow Jesus. And as luck, or Jesus would have it, my stepfather helped Mommy enforce those same rules when he married her. The old-timers at New Brown used to say, God honored Reverend McBride. The man died without a penny, yet his children grew up to graduate from college, to become doctors, professors, teachers, and professionals all. It was the work, they said, of none other than Jesus Christ himself. At the moment, the lady who helped Jesus Christ shepherd Reverend McBride's children to adulthood, and the surviving founder of the New Brown Memorial Baptist Church, is sitting at the end of a long table on the dais, the only white person in the room, wearing a blue print dress and holding my 2-year-old daughter Azure in her lap. It took a lot to get Mommy here. She didn't want to come. The church got a fine new minister in 1989, and one of his first acts was to order my father's picture to be taken down from behind the pulpit of New Brown to be placed in a new vestibule constructed with money from the We Still Need More church fund, all of which fell into the nebulous category of We're Building Up God's House, which meant it might not happen while Mommy is still alive. To compound this, he made the mistake of not formally recognizing her during service when she came to visit the church. That was a huge error on his part that could have been easily remedied if somewhere between reading the Prayer for the Sick and Shut-In list and the Happy Birthday to Our Members list, he could have squeezed in a, We welcome our original founder, Mrs. McBride, to church today. Can I get an amen? The whole thing would have blown over, but he didn't. Instead, he treated her like an outsider, a foreigner, a white person, greeting her after the service with the obsequious smile and false sincerity that blacks reserve for white folks when they don't know them that well, or don't trust them, or both. I saw that same grin on a black waiter's face when the Washington Post once sent me to the White House to cover a Nancy Reagan shindig. A smile for Miss Ann, the white lady. Not good. Ma was so hurt, she resolved never to go back there again, a promise she broke again and again, braving the 2-hour subway and train commute from her home in Ewing, New Jersey, to sit in church, the only white person in the room, a stranger in the very church that she started in her living room. In all fairness, the minister was new. He hadn't much experience and did not know her. In fact, none of the new people at church knew her, and at some point the man corrected his error, but that, Ma said, was not the point. These new ministers have no vision, she fumed. They just want a chicken sandwich. Now your father, he had vision. She compared them all to my father, but there really was no comparison. Those were different times, different circumstances, different men. For years, Mommy rarely talked about my father. It was as if his death was so long ago that she couldn't remember. But deep inside, she saw her marriage to him as the beginning of her life, and thus his death as part of its end. And to reach any farther beyond that into her past was to go into hell, an area that she didn't want to touch. In order to steer clear of the most verboten area, the Jewish side, she steered clear of him as well. Her memory was like a minefield, each recollection a potential booby trap, a bouncing Betty, the old landmines the Viet Cong used in the Vietnam War that never went off when you stepped on them, but blew you to hell the moment you pulled your foot away. But when she did speak of him, it always began with reverence and ended with sadness, with her saying, I never knew how sick he was. I used to stare at his pictures and wonder what his voice sounded like until I met my cousin, Linwood Bob Henson from North Carolina, who looks just like him. If you want to know what your father was like, Ma said, talk to Bob. Bob is about 40. He talks with a pleasant down-home North Carolina twang. He manages a post office in a small, all-white town, solving problems for angry postal customers. Bob was one of 16 blacks who first integrated his high school in Mount Gilead, North Carolina, where my father was born. He is a quiet, humorous, religious man of solid accomplishment. He lost his 14-year-old son, Tori, in a tragic car accident that sent an entire North Carolina community of blacks and whites reeling in sorrow, and he comforted others even as his own heart was torn in two. If my son grows up to be like Bob, I'll be a happy man. But everyone can't be like Bob, or Reverend McBride, or even Ruth McBride. People are different. Times change. Ministers change. Mommy knows this, and despite her personal differences with the new minister, she didn't want to see what amounted to my father's and her life's work disappear. So she gathered a few donations from my siblings and came to the dinner, sitting at the end of the dais. Next to her is the keynote speaker, Hunson Green, head of the New York Baptist Ministers Conference and a tremendous speaker, who also happens to be the brother of Mommy's late best friend, Irene Johnson. When it comes to Jesus, Mommy, who scorns the black bourgeoisie, has friends in high places. After a while, the young minister mounts the dais and works the crowd like a warm-up comedian. His remarks are short and funny. The steak's not bad, he jokes. The vegetables not too rubbery. It's a Saturday night. Eat up, y'all. We got church in the morning. He moves down the program swiftly. Three of the scheduled anointed speakers did not show, among them church founders Reverend Thomas McNair, my godfather, and Sister Virginia Ingram, both having pleaded illness or scheduling conflicts. Finally, Mommy is called to the podium. The new minister introduces her as the original founder of our church. He scores big points there. Mommy sets my daughter down, rises, and makes her way to the stage. It takes her forever to get there. She's 74 now. Her knees don't work that well. The quick, bow-legged stride is more of a waddle. The lean, pretty woman I knew as a boy has become a small, slightly stooped, cute, feisty old lady. Her face is still the same, the dark eyes full of pep and fire. The hair is still black, thanks to Clairol hair dye. And because she never drank or smoked, and practices yoga 3 times a week, she looks 10 years younger than she is. But she has heart disease and high blood pressure now and takes medication for both. After her heart disease was diagnosed, my physician brothers wanted to schedule her for further tests with top heart specialists, but she refused. "They're not going to get me," she mused, the amorphous they being hospitals, the system, and anything else that sticks tubes in you and takes your money at the same time. She moves slower now, and stares are a challenge. Lately, she's been given to talking as if she won't be around much longer, prefacing each plan with, "Well, if I'm still here next year, I'd love to see Disneyland, a grandchild's graduation, Paris again, a new car." Some of it is smoke, some of it not. All of it sends my heart spiraling to the floor. Like most people, I don't know what I'll do when my mother makes that final walk home. When she reaches the podium, I snap out of my reverie. In her hand is a crumpled piece of paper containing a half-typed, half-longhand speech. The paper is trembling in her hands. She slowly places the paper down and pulls the microphone closer to her face so that it feeds back a bit. As she does so, every hat, every tie, every spoon in the audience is completely still. "Greetings to the Honorable Reverend Reed and the pulpit guests," she reads in a high-pitched, breathless voice. "New Brown has..." And she stops right away. Whether it's the emotion of the moment or just plain nervousness, it's hard to tell. But Mommy has never given a speech before, ever. She clears her throat as a chorus of amens and go-on-honeys resounds about the room. She starts again. "Greetings to the Honorable Reverend Reed and the pulpit guests. New Brown has come this far by faith." And this time she plows forward, reckless, fast, like a motorized car going through snowdrifts, spinning, peeling out, traveling in circles, going nowhere, her words nearly indecipherable as she flies through the stilted speech in her high-pitched, nervous voice. Finally, she stops and puts a hand over her heart and breathes deeply as an embarrassing silence covers the room. I'm about to rush the stage, thinking she's having a heart attack, when she suddenly ditches the speech, the page fluttering to the floor, and speaks directly to the microphone. "My husband wanted to start a church, but we had no money, so he said, 'Let's start it right here in our living room.' We cleaned up the house and set up a pulpit with a white tablecloth and invited the McNairs and the Ingrams and the Taylors and the Floods over. That's how we started." "Amen," comes from the audience. She's lit a fire now. "We set up chairs and read the Bible and had service. We didn't have an organ player like Sister Lee. We sang without it. Those were the happiest days of my life, and I want you to know." She stops as tears jump into her eyes. "Amen. Yes, tell us what you want us to know, honey." She starts again. "I want you to know. Go on. Tell it." She takes a deep breath. "I want you to know you are looking at a witness of God's word." "It's real," she said. "It's real." Amens roar across the room as she turns and walks away from the pulpit. The pep back in her stride now. The waddle gone. 74 years of life dropping off her like snowflakes as she stands behind her seat on the podium facing the audience, overcome. "God bless you all in the name of Christ," she shouts, striking at the air with her fist and sitting down, her face red, nose red, tears everywhere. In my own eyes as well. Later on the way home in the car, I ask her, "So, I guess you're not mad at the new minister now." "Leave that man alone," she says, as the streetlights twinkle and wink off her face. "He's doing a good job. You're lucky to have a young minister the way things are in these churches today. You should be a minister. You ever think about that? Ah, but you need foresight and vision. You got vision?" I tell her, I don't think I do. Well, if you don't have it, don't waste God's time. Finding Ruthie. Back in June 1993, during the course of putting together Mommy's will, something I had to force her to do, the macabre subject of her burial came up. When I die, she said, don't bury me in New Jersey. Who wants to be buried in Jersey? She spoke these words as she was sitting in the kitchen of the home she shares with my sister Kathy in Ewing Township near Trenton, a lovely area of New Jersey. I said, we'll bury you in Virginia, next to your second husband. Oh, no, don't bury me in Virginia. I ran away from Virginia. I don't want to go back there. How about North Carolina? We'll bury you where your first husband is. No way. I spent all my life running from the South. Don't put me in the South. Okay, New York, I said. You lived there 40 years. You still love New York. Too crowded, she sniffed. They bury them 3 deep in New York. I don't want to be smushed up under somebody when I'm buried. Where should we bury you, then? She threw up her hands. Who cares? This is nonsense. I've got nothing to leave y'all anyway except some bills. She got up from the kitchen table, bristling, and snapped. Bury me here. Bury me there. What are you trying to do, kill me? I don't want no tubes in me, whatever you do. A doctor will kill you faster than anything. She reached for the sun visor. Your sister did this to me, she said. Did what? I had a little bump on my face, and she made me see this fancy doctor. Now I gotta wear this dumb hat all the time. It makes me look like a rooster. Doctors found squamous cell cancer in a small mole they removed from Ma's face, a condition caused by too much exposure to the sun. Ironically, it's a condition that affects mostly white people. To the very end, Mommy is a flying compilation of competing interests and conflicts. A black woman in white skin, with black children, and a white woman's physical problem. Fortunately, the doctors got the mole off in time, but the question of her own mortality is one she seems to be preoccupied with of late, probably because she knows death is the one condition in life she can't outrun. Death is strange, isn't it? She wonders. It's so final. You know, time is not promised, she says, wagging a finger. That's why you better get to know Jesus. If it takes as long to know Jesus as it took to know you, I think, I'm in trouble. It took many years to find out who she was, partly because I never knew who I was. It wasn't so much a question of searching for myself as it was my own decision not to look. As a boy, I was confused about issues of race, but did not consider myself deprived or unhappy. As a young man, I had no time or money or inclination to look beyond my own poverty to discover what identity was. Once I got out of high school and found that I wasn't in jail, I thought I was in the clear. Oberlin College was gravy, all you could eat and no one telling you what to do and your own job to boot if you wanted one. Yet I laughed bitterly at the white kids in ragged jeans who frolicked on the campus lawn tossing frisbees and went about campus caroling in German at Christmas. They seemed free in ways I could not be. Most of my friends and the women I dated were black, yet as time passed, I developed relationships with white students as well, two of whom, Leander Bean and Laurie Wiseman, are close friends of mine today. During the rare, inopportune social moments when I found myself squeezed between black and white, I fled to the black side, just as my mother had done, and did not emerge unless driven out by smoke and fire. Being mixed is like that tingling feeling you have in your nose just before you sneeze. You're waiting for it to happen, but it never does. Given my black face and upbringing, it was easy for me to flee into the anonymity of blackness. Yet I felt frustrated to live in a world that considers the color of your face an immediate political statement whether you like it or not. It took years before I began to accept the fact that the nebulous white man's world wasn't as free as it looked. That class, luck, religion all factored in as well. That many white individuals' problems surpassed my own, often by a lot. That all Jews are not like my grandfather, and that part of me is Jewish too. Yet the color boundary in my mind was, and still is, the greatest hurdle. In order to clear it, my solution was to stay away from it and fly solo. I ran for as long as I could. After I graduated from Oberlin College in 1979 and received my master's degree in journalism from Columbia University in 1980, I began a process of vacillating between music and writing that would take 8 years to complete before I realized I could work successfully as a writer and musician. I quit every journalism job I ever had. I worked at the Wilmington News Journal and quit. The Boston Globe, quit. People Magazine, Us Magazine, The Washington Post, quit them all. This was before the age of 30. I must have had some modicum of talent because I kept getting hired, but I wore my shirt and tie like an imposter. I wandered around the cities by day, stumbling into the newsroom at night, exhausted, to write my stories. I loved an empty city room, just the blinking terminals and a few deadbeats like myself. It was the only time I could write, away from white reporters, black reporters, away from this synergy of black and white that was already simmering inside my soul, ready to burst out at the most inopportune moments. Being caught between black and white as a working adult was far more unpleasant than when I was a college student. I watched as the world of blacks and whites smashed together in newsrooms and threw off chunks of human carnage that landed at my feet. I'd hear black reporters speaking angrily about a sympathetic white editor, and I'd disagree, in silence. White men ruled the kingdom, sometimes ruthlessly, finding clever ways to gut the careers of fine black reporters who came into the business full of piss and vinegar, yet other white men were mere pawns, like myself. Most of my immediate editors were white women, whom I found in general to be the most compassionate, humane, and often brightest in the newsroom, yet they rarely rose to the top. Even when compared to their more conservative black male counterparts, some of whom marched around the newsrooms as if they were the second coming of Martin Luther King, wielding their race like baseball bats. They were no closer to the black man in the ghetto than were their white counterparts. They spoke of their days of growing up in Mississippi, or wherever it was, as proof of their knowledge of poverty and blackness. But in fact, the closest most of them had come to an urban ghetto in 20 years was from behind the wheel of a locked Honda. Their claims of growing up poor were without merit in my mind. They grew up privileged, not deprived, because they had mothers, fathers, grandparents, neighbors, church, family, a system that protected, sheltered, and raised them. They did not grow up like the children of the 80s and 90s, stripped of any semblance of family other than the constant presence of drugs and violence. There, I was raised with nothing and went to Harvard anyway, experience, was the criterion that white editors used to hire them. But then again, that was partly how I got through, too. The whole business made me want to scream. I had no true personal life in those days. Few dates, few dinners, no power lunches. My college sweetheart, a mixed-race woman from Hyde Park, Chicago, her mother was black and her father Jewish, was the apple of my eye. But I was afraid of commitment then, afraid to have children because I didn't want them to be like me. I drifted away from her and let time and distance do the rest. Since I had no personal life outside of journalism other than music, I soared as a reporter. But I always parachuted out in the end, telling my white editor after a year or two that I had to leave to find myself, write a book, play my sax, whatever the excuse was. Most black folks consider finding myself a luxury. White people seem to think of it as a necessity, most white people, that is, except for that all-important one. Each time I quit a job, Mommy would do a war dance, complete with chants and dancing, usually beginning with, "Now what are you gonna do? You had a second chance and you threw it out the window. You need a job." Like most mothers, she wielded tremendous power, and my staunch resolve would crumble like a sandcastle before her frontal assaults, which were like tidal waves. I'd stave her off and back out of the house saying, "Don't worry, Ma, don't worry," disappearing into the underworld labyrinth of the New York music scene for months, playing sax with this or that band, selling a piece of music here and there. I was always moderately successful, and later in life much more so, winning the Stephen Sondheim Award for Musical Theater Composition, working with Anita Baker, Grover Washington Jr., Jimmy Scott, Rochelle Farrell, and many others. But the 80s were hard times for me as a composer, and each time I hit a dry spell, I'd scurry back to journalism, until February 1988, when I was working for the Washington Post style section and thinking of quitting to go back to music in New York. The Post style section is the top of the line, the elite, the haute cuisine, the green, green grass of heaven for newspaper feature writers, and quitting there is not something you do lightly, not even for a seasoned quitter like myself. As I pondered it, Ma called me out of the blue, smelling trouble. "I know you," she snapped. "You're getting steady money now, and a lot of it. Don't quit that job." But I did quit. partly because I got tired of running, and partly because the little ache I had known as a boy was no longer a little ache when I reached 30. It was a giant, roaring, musical riff, screaming through my soul like a distorted rock guitar with the sound turned all the way up, telling me, get on with your life. Play sax, write books, compose music, do something, express yourself. Who the hell are you anyway? There were two worlds bursting inside me trying to get out. I had to find more about who I was. And in order to find out who I was, I had to find out who my mother was. It was a devastating realization, coming to grips with the fact that all your life, you had never really known the person you loved the most. Even as a young boy, I was used to Mommy hiding her past, and I grew to accept it. And the details of her past got lost as my own life moved forward, which is probably how she wanted it anyway. I never even seriously broached the subject with her until 1977, when I was in college and had to fill out a form that, for some reason or other, required Ma's maiden name. I called her long distance in Philadelphia to find out, and she was suddenly evasive. "What do you need that for?" she asked. "How come?" She hemmed and hawed a while longer before finally coming out with it. "Shilsky," she said. "Can you spell that, Ma?" "Who's paying for this call? Am I paying for it? Did you call me collect?" "No, you're in college," she snapped. "You can spell. Figure it out yourself. Click." The subject was not broached again until I met Al Larkin, then Sunday magazine editor at the Boston Globe in early 1982. Al talked me into writing a Mother's Day piece, which the Philadelphia Inquirer was kind enough to run simultaneously, since Ma was living in Philly at the time. The public response to the piece was so overwhelming, I decided to delve further, partly to get out of working for a living, and partly to expel some of my own demons regarding my brown skin, curly hair, and divided soul. I asked Mommy if she would be interested in doing a book, and she said, no. I told her it could make me $1 million, and she said, okay, if you're rich, I'm rich. Just don't quit your job. So I took a leave of absence from the Boston Globe in 1982 and then quit. "That was one of the stupidest things you have ever done," she snorted when I announced I'd quit. I expected to sit down with her and conduct long, rambling interviews, listening intently as the painful, fascinating details of her life came tumbling out. I envisioned her as the wise sage, sitting in a rocking chair, impassively pouring the moving details of her life into my waiting tape recorder over 6 weeks, maybe 2 months, me prodding her along, her cooperating, cringing, inching along, mother and son, hand in hand, fighting forward, emotionally wrought until, behold, we'd be done 6 months later and the world would be graced with our mighty tome. 8 years later, I was still getting this. "Mind your own business. If you think too hard, your mind dries up like a prune. I don't want a TV special named after me. Leave me alone. You're a nosy body. I'm moving out of Philly. Let's pack up the house." My mother is the only individual I have ever known who has been in the process of moving for 10 years straight. After living in Delaware for only a year, she bought a small row house in Germantown, Philadelphia in 1975, settled in, and promptly began the process of looking for another place to move that literally became a lifestyle. She seemed to know every realtor in Germantown on a first-name basis. She would rise in the morning, scoot out the door, and ride around with a realtor all day looking at houses which she had neither the money for nor the desire to buy, telling the poor realtor after the day was done to call me in a week. She'd then clear out of town completely, moving to Atlanta for 3 weeks to stay with my siblings, or just disappear from sight, never to be seen by the realtor again. The poor guy would call and call, and one of us would finally break the news to him that Mommy wasn't interested. Sometimes Mommy would be standing by the phone whispering to us in one ear while we were running interference for her with the other. "Tell him I'm not here," she'd hiss. "Why does he keep bothering me?" It was typical Mommy neurotic behavior, and I didn't fully understand it till I learned how far she had truly come. For her, her Jewish side is gone. She opened the door for me but closed it for herself long ago, and for her to crack it open and peek inside was like eating fire. She'd look in and stagger back, blinded, as the facts of her own history poured over her like lava. As she revealed the facts of her life, I felt helpless, like I was watching her die and be reborn again. Yet there was a cleansing element, too, because after years of hiding, she opened up and began to talk about her past. And as she did so, I was the one who wanted to run for cover. I can't describe what a shock it was to hear words like Tata and Rove and Shiva and Bubba coming from Mommy's mouth as she sat at the kitchen table in her Ewing home. Imagine, if you will, 5,000 years of Jewish history landing in your lap in the space of months. It sent me tumbling through my own abyss of sorts, trying to salvage what I could of my feelings and emotions, which would be scattered to the winds as she talked. It was a fascinating lesson in life history, a truth is stranger than fiction marvel, to say the least. I felt like a Tinker Toy kid building my own self out of one of those toy building sets, for as she laid her life before me, I reassembled the tableau of her words like a picture puzzle, and as I did, so my own life was rebuilt. Mommy's has changed, changed from the time she adopted Christianity back in the 1940s. What's different is that she can face the past now. After years of saying, "Don't tell my business," she reached the point where she now says, "It doesn't matter. They're all dead now, or in Florida," which in her mind is the same as being dead. "I'll never retire to Florida," she vowed. Riding past a graveyard one day, she looked over and remarked, "That's Florida forever." Ma settled in to get her college degree in social work from Temple University at age 65. She enjoyed the intellectual back and forth, the study, reading different authors. I'd forgotten how bright she was. The constant learning and yearning for knowledge was what helped her finally move away from the bustle of Philadelphia to settle into the quieter, safer suburb of Ewing with my sister Kathy. For a few years, she used her degree to work as a volunteer in a Philadelphia social service agency that helped pregnant, unwed mothers. Then she moved on to run a weekly reading group for literate and illiterate senior citizens at the local Ewing Library, which she still does today. But that's not enough to keep her busy. Every day she rises, spirits her two grandchildren off to school, and drives around central New Jersey, haggling with merchants at flea markets, taking yoga classes in sweats and Nikes, tooling along in a 1995 Toyota at 27 miles an hour in a 55-mile-an-hour zone, holding up traffic on Route 1 listening to Bernard Meltzer on WORAM or the Howard Stern Show. "Grandma laughs when Howard Stern talks dirty," my niece Maya whispers. Sometimes she'll get up in the morning and disappear for days at a time, slipping away to her old stomping grounds, the Red Hook Housing Projects, to go to church and see her old friends there. She loves Red Hook. Despite the fact that my siblings often urge her to stay out of the projects, she won't. "Don't tell me how to live," she says. She's always been slightly out of control, my mother. Always had the unnerving habit of taking the ship into the air to do loops and spins, then fleeing the cockpit screaming, "Someone do something, we're gonna crash!" Then, at the last dying second, slipping into the pilot's seat and coolly landing the thing herself, only to forget the entire incident instantly. She wouldn't recall it for you if you showed her pictures of herself doing it. She wipes her memory instantly and with purpose. It's a way of preserving herself. That's how she moves. Her survival instincts are incredible. Her dances with fire always fun to watch. Ruthie, my sisters affectionately call her, Ruthie's crazy. In August 1993, after more than 50 years, Ruthie, a.k.a. Ruth McBride Jordan, a.k.a. Rachel Deborah Shilsky, finally faced the ghosts of her pasts. She went home to Suffolk, Virginia with me, my sister Judy, a New York school teacher, and my brother Billy, an Atlanta physician, in tow. We drove through the entire town, down Main Street, past the one building in town that had an elevator back in the 30s, past the spot where her old home had been, past the old synagogue and old high school, which was still there. "Nothing's changed," she breathed as we sat in front of the old synagogue, still white, aged, but slightly noble with its four tall columns. Ma stared at the old temple, but refused to get out of the car. She merely looked out the window. "They sure do take care of it," she muttered, then ordered Billy, who was driving, to pull away. She seemed immobile, attentive, reflective, but unmoved, until we pulled into the Portsmouth driveway of one Francis Moody, now Francis Falcone, whom I found after a long search. It took 12 years and a ton of good luck for me to find the mysterious Francis. It was, after all, 50 years since Mommy had been there and most of the old-timers had gone. Those that remained did not remember or know anyone named Frances. Finally, I came across a woman named Frances Holland, who told me about two girls who befriended her when she was a new student in the 7th grade at Thomas Jefferson Junior High, Ruth Shilsky and Frances Moody. Frances Moody's alive, living in Portsmouth somewhere, she said. A search through the directory turned up nothing, and I was empty-handed until I visited the town library in Suffolk, and a librarian handed me a slip of paper with a phone number on it. "This is the woman you're looking for," she said. "She's Frances Falcone now." I thanked her and asked her how she knew. She shrugged. She didn't seem to be friendly or unfriendly, just matter of fact. She picked up the phone, dialed a number, and handed me the phone. Frances Moody, now Frances Falcone, was on the other line. "I've been looking for you for years," I said. She laughed. "Come see me, but I might not be able to see you," she said. "I had an operation on my eyes yesterday for cataracts." Right away, I drove to Portsmouth and met my mother's childhood friend, a slim, brown-haired, soft-spoken woman of Mommy's age, whose eyes, it turned out, were working just fine. It seems fitting that Frances Moody, who crossed the line and made a Jewish friend in the 1940s when Jews were unpopular in Suffolk, had married an Italian, Nick Falcone, a wood artisan. "The last time I saw your mother, she gave me a shower for my wedding," Frances said. "That was in 1941. "I bet you thought you'd never see her again," I said. "No," she said. "I knew I'd see her again, somehow." As we neared Frances's house in Portsmouth, Mommy began to get nervous and to talk excessively. "Look at these roads," she said. "Not a bump, not a notch. They fix them down here in Virginia, but you shouldn't speed on them because the cops here don't play. They don't play. You hear me, Billy? Slow down. Oh, my knees. The air conditioning really bothers my knees, and these seats are too small." Even after we pulled into the driveway of Frances's house and her friend approached, she was still babbling away, complaining now. "Oh, I can't get up now. My legs hurt. Help me to get up. What the heck are y'all trying to do anyway, driving so fast like that? You can't drive like that in Virginia, I tell you. Now my knees hurt. And, oh, Frances, look at how thin you are. Oh, you're so pretty. Oh, I'm crying now. Oh, boy, what are you trying to do?" And she wept as she hugged her friend. After the trip, she and Frances picked up where their high school friendship left off and remained close today. But Frances is as far back as Ruthie can go. Her reunion with her old friend is one of the small, beautiful side benefits of a book experience that Mommy was truly never interested in, exploring a past for her that in many ways is gone forever and is better left buried and untouched. There are probably 100 reasons why Ruthie should have stayed on the Jewish side, instead of taking New Jersey Transit and the F train to go to a Christian church in Red Hook, Brooklyn, with her Schwarzer children and friends. And I'm sure the Old Testament lists them all. But I'm glad she came over to the African-American side. She married two extraordinary men and raised 12 very creative and talented children, and I ought to list their names now. After all, that was part of the deal on my end, and her children's achievements are her life's work anyway. So, from the eldest to the youngest, Andrew Dennis McBride, B.A., Lincoln University, M.D., University of Pennsylvania Medical School, M.A., Public Health, Yale University, Director of Health Department, City of Stamford, Connecticut. Rosetta McBride, B.A., Howard University, M.S.W., Social Work, Hunter College, Staff Psychologist, New York City Board of Education. William McBride, B.A., Lincoln University, M.D., Yale University School of Medicine, M.B.A., Emory University School of Business, Medical Director, Southeast Region, Medical and Scientific Affairs, Merck and Company, Incorporated. David McBride, B.A., Denison University, M.A., History, Columbia University, Ph.D., History, Columbia University, Chairman of Afro-American History Department, Pennsylvania State University. Helen McBride Richter, R.N., Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, G.O.N.P., Emory University School of Medicine, Graduate Student in Nurse Midwifery, Emory University School of Nursing. Richard McBride, U.S. Army Veteran, B.A., Cheney University, Chemistry. M.S., Drexel University, Associate Professor of Chemistry, Cheney State, and Chemistry Research Associate, AT&T. Dorothy McBride Wesley, A.A., Pierce Junior College, B.A., LaSalle University, Medical Practice Office Manager, Atlanta, Georgia. James McBride, B.A., Oberlin College, M.S.J., Journalism, Columbia University, writer, composer, saxophonist. Kathy Jordan,
B.A., Syracuse University. M.S., Education, Long Island University. Special Education Teacher, Ewing High School, Ewing, New Jersey. Judy Jordan, B.A., Adelphi University, M.A., Columbia University Teachers College, Teacher, Junior High School, 168, Manhattan. Hunter Jordan, B.S., Computer Engineering, Syracuse University. Computer Consultant, U.S. Trust Corporation, and Taylor. Henry Jordan, Junior at North Carolina A&T University, Customer Service and Purchasing, Neal Manufacturing Incorporated, Greensboro, North Carolina. And last but not least, Ruth Jordan, B.A., Temple University, 1986. Mommy's children are extraordinary people, most of them leaders in their own right. All of them have toted more mental baggage and dealt with more hardship than they care to remember. Yet they carry themselves with a giant measure of dignity, humility, and humor. Like any family, we have problems, but we have always been close. Through marriage, adoptions, love-ins, live-ins, and shack-ups, the original dozen has expanded into dozens and dozens more. Wives, husbands, children, grandchildren, cousins, nieces, nephews, ranging from dark-skinned to light-skinned, from black kinky hair to blonde hair and blue eyes. In running from her past, Mommy has created her own nation, a rainbow coalition that descends on her house every Christmas and Thanksgiving and sleeps everywhere, on the floor, on rugs, in shifts, sleeping double, triple to a bed, two up, three down, just like old times. Every year we argue over where to have Christmas. Every year we spend hundreds of dollars on phone calls and letters, writing, faxing, cajoling, and bribing, trying to get out of the pilgrimage to Mommy's tiny house in Ewing. Every year, all 12 of us claim we're going to have Christmas at our own house, and we're not going to travel a zillion miles with a zillion children to sleep with a zillion people on the floor of Mars like we're little kids, because we're just tired, man, and we did that last year. But at age 74, the president, CEO, and commander-in-chief of this here army still has the power. My wife, Stephanie, tells a funny story about the first time she came home with me for Christmas and met my family. We were sitting around Ma's house in Ewing, all 12 siblings, doctors, professors all. The house as wild as it always was when we were little, our kids going crazy and our spouses numb, while Mommy's original dozen fell back into nutty behavioral patterns that would make a psychologist throw up his hands in despair. When someone shouted over the din, "Let's go to the movies!" Instantly, the room sprang into overdrive. "Good idea, yeah, let's go, I'll drive," from another room. "Wait for me, hurry up, where's my shoes?" Mommy was sitting on the living room couch while all this was happening, her feet resting on the coffee table. She yawned and said softly, "I want to eat." The movie was instantly forgotten. "Yeah, let's eat. I sure am hungry. Let's order out," from another room. "I've been waiting to eat all day." Now that's what you call power. Epilogue. In November 1942, a 21-year-old Jewish woman named Helena Wind was sent by her parents into hiding after the Nazis marched into her home village of Turka, Poland, and murdered most of the town's 6,000 Jews, eventually killing her parents, a brother, and a grandmother. Helena Wind fled to the city of Lvov, where she and 9 other Jews hid in a sewer for 14 months, living amidst rats and sewer filth in a wet, underground prison, never seeing the sunlight, fed by 3 Polish sewer workers. Helena Wind survived that horror and lived to tell the world of it. In 1980, nearly 40 years later, Helena's only son, David Lee Preston, a tall, thin, handsome dude with a lean face, dark eyes, and glasses, wandered over to my desk at the Wilmington News Journal holding a story I had written about boxer Muhammad Ali. He was a reporter at the paper like I was, but we had never met. "This is an excellent piece," he said. "Thanks," I said. "You spelled Muhammad wrong. It's with an A at the end, not an E. The copy desk missed it." The copy desk is supposed to catch those kinds of errors before they make the paper. "Okay," I shrugged, no sweat off my back. "I heard you're a sax player," he said. "You ever heard of Albert Ayler?" Albert Ayler was an amazing avant-garde saxophonist known only to the most die-hard jazz enthusiasts. Rumor has it, he disappeared into Manhattan's East River wearing cement shoes. I was completely surprised. "How'd you hear of him?" I asked. He shrugged and smiled. From that day to this, Helena Wynn's son has been one of my best friends. I didn't know David Preston was a Jew when I first met him. He didn't wear it on his sleeve. He was a compassionate, curious, humorous intellectual, a great writer, and his religious background never came up, nor did it seem important to me at the time. Only when I revealed to him that my mother was the daughter of an Orthodox Jewish rabbi did his Jewish background emerge, because he understood the true depth of Mommy's experience immediately. "What a woman," he said. This from a guy who was raised by an amazing woman himself. As his life moved forward, today he is writing a book about his mother and working as the South Jersey columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. So did mine. I asked him to be in my wedding when I married my African-American wife, Stephanie, in 1991. He asked me to do the same when he married his Jewish wife, Rondé, the following year. He also wanted Mommy to come to his wedding. I agreed to ask her for him, though privately I had my doubts. "Interesting," that was her response when I put it to her. "He really wants you to come," I said. I knew she liked David immensely. "I'll come if Kathy comes with me," she said. Ma likes her daughters to come with her for anything emotional. Her sons she likes to brag about and say what great things they've done and what schools they've gone to and on, but in truth, it's the women of the McBride-Jordan clan who hold the family together and will do so after she is gone. Like Mommy, my sisters have learned to absorb punishment and get up off the ground after the shock of life's blows wears off. The men, yours truly included, wallow about as life's details mow us down and lay us out on Mommy's couch to watch bowl games when the family gathers at Christmas and Thanksgiving, no matter how lousy the games are. Kathy agreed to come to the wedding with her 9-year-old daughter, Maya, and we were on. It was held at Temple Beth Shalom in Wilmington, where Helena Wynn Preston had taught for 3 decades. I was an usher in the wedding, and as I marched down the aisle wearing a black tuxedo and a white yarmulke, behind 6 Jewish musicians who played the traditional Israeli folk song, Erev Shel Shoshanim, I felt somber, moved, and proud. David Preston married his wife with the kind of gusto and enthusiasm and seriousness with which he attacks everything in life. They signed a contract. They were married under a huppah, a wedding canopy. 2 cantors, one of whom was David's sister, Sherry Preston, stepped forward and sang. David's uncle, Helena Wynn's brother, Rabbi Leon Wend, presided over the ceremony and spoke eloquently with reverence and power. "My heart is filled with deep and conflicting emotions today," the 78-year-old rabbi said. "I'm overjoyed that your marriage has come, yet my heart aches because my sister, for whom this would have been the supreme moment of her life, did not live to see it." David's mother, Helena Wynn Preston, died after open-heart surgery in December 1982 at the age of 61. The rabbi's heartfelt words moved the entire congregation, and my thoughts traveled to my own Jewish mother, who was sitting in the 4th row. I turned to peek as Mommy wiped her reddening nose with a handkerchief, a camera strapped around her wrist. At moments like this, she usually likes to shoot pictures. She catches all of her important moments with a camera, waddling down Brooklyn's Atlantic Avenue from the A-train to Long Island College Hospital to take pictures of my daughter Azure's first days of life, standing my toddler son Jordan up against a tree in her yard so she can snap a quick picture of him in his Easter outfit. Her photos are horrible, heads cut off, pictures of nothing, a table, a hand, a chair. Still, she shoots pictures of any event that's important to her, knowing that each memory is too important to lose, having lost so many before. However, she is snapping no pictures now. She's staring straight ahead, wearing a white dress with a necklace this rainy afternoon, her long nose and dark eyes seeming to blend in perfectly with the mostly Eastern European faces surrounding her. She had no problems walking into the synagogue. She looked about the lobby and nodded her approval. "Oh, yes, this is the memorial wall where they put the names of the ones who died," she pointed out. "Oh, yes, the men will leave the room if a woman canter performs." She talked as if she were visiting a museum. "How do you feel being here?" I asked her. "I feel fine," she said. "I'm happy to see David getting married. He's a nice Jewish boy." She laughed at the irony of it. I realized then that whoever had said Kaddish for Mommy, the Jewish prayer of mourning, the declaration of death, the ritual that absolves them of responsibility for the child's fate, had done the right thing. Because Mommy was truly gone from their world. In her mind, She was a guest here. I don't have this left in me anymore, she remarked at one point. Downstairs at the reception following the ceremony, Mommy perked up even more as the klezmer musicians played traditional Jewish folk songs. She ate kosher hummus, tahini, and baba ganoush, and explained the importance of kosher food to my niece Maya. She laughed and joked with a group of Jewish ladies who sat next to us, and even got up to watch me help other men place David Preston in a chair, lift him up and carry him around the room in the traditional Jewish men's wedding dance. But not long after, she came back to our table and announced, "It's time to go," in a tone and manner that said she really was ready to leave. When we opened the synagogue door, it was raining outside and we had no umbrellas. Kathy and Maya made a quick dash for the car, running ahead while Mommy and I followed. "That's how it's done," Mommy said as I helped her down the synagogue stairs, her arthritic knees aching in the damp weather. "That's how the old Jews did it in my day, too. You marry under that thing, the huppah. You break the glass. You know, that could have been me," she said as she took the last stair and her foot landed shakily on the sidewalk. "I know," I said, releasing her arm and walking toward the car. "And where would that have left me?" But suddenly I was talking to myself. She was gone. I stopped and turned to look behind me. She was standing in front of the synagogue entrance, staring up at the doorway from the sidewalk, lost in thought, the rain billowing into puddles around her. She stood there for a moment in the downpour, staring thoughtfully, before turning and hurrying toward the car, her bow-legged waddle, just the same as it always was.
Phoenix Audio, copyright 2005, produced by Michael Wiener.